Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. I just saw a report this morning that because Thanksgiving in the U.S. was on the 28th, which is is the last day that it's possible to be scheduled. It's always on the fourth Thursday, I think, of November. Mm-hmm. Right. So it shifts from, I think, the 22nd to the 28th. And this year was pretty late. And one of the ramifications of that, because of the way our consumer-driven purchase environment is that the post office and FedEx and UPS and all the other delivery services have essentially a week less time to deliver the same amount of packages. For whatever reason, mm-hmm. Thanksgiving is the trigger to go buy stuff and mail stuff to people and send packages and order things and so on. And so talking to our local mail carrier, she says, yep, we're getting slammed already. It was, the week before Thanksgiving, it was picking up a little bit. And yesterday was just overwhelm. People were ordering Friday and this weekend, and it's showing up.
Do more in less time.
Yeah. And so that part of, and I think of it as it impacts supply chain. I remember going way back to when I'm setting up experiments or running designs or whatever, if I ordered it at this time of year, it just took longer to get it. The mm-hmm. materials were more scarce. Packaging and shipping was more scarce. All those other pieces that just slowed the process down. I would have loved to have the overnight shipping when I was setting up experiments way back when, because I'd order thermocouples and it would take 3 weeks to show up.
That's right. It was so slow back then.
Right.
And then you got, and it started, I don't know if it started in automotive. I believe it did, but the just-in-time inventorying when.
Yeah, that was your fault. That was your fault.
The interesting story that just came to mind. Do you mind if I share it? Back years ago when I was first starting out as a reliability manager, I got this concept in my head that we needed to get reliability requirements integrated into the company. And in other words, not just an afterthought.
Right.
And we needed to get people actually thinking in terms of what is the reliability. And I use those four aspects of the definition. So you got a number, you have the functions, you have the conditions of use, you have the time element,
right?
And turning those into requirements for different projects. So we'd have the new Corvette program or a new Impala program or whatever, and let's get for the different subsystems and components, let's get reliability requirements. And one of the things I ran into is, this is all well and good for a door system or a seat system or that, but a lot of those components, and in many cases subsystems, are designed and built by suppliers.
Oh, yeah.
And those suppliers don't have reliability requirements. In fact, I went up and down. This is so humorous. I went up and down the boardrooms in GM saying, going into offices saying, do you have responsibility for supplier reliability? Who has responsibility? And the answer essentially was no one, because they had responsibility for quality, for timing. And,
yeah, delivery, yeah. Costs, yeah, all those
but
things.
Not reliability.
Yeah, when I was at HP, it was a subset of the quality aspect of it. So the quality organization and or the program itself, the supply chain folks would look at the quality, which included reliability. And once I, like you, started to expose that as a weakness, it started getting more calls from supply chain folks just before they would head out on a grand tour of all these suppliers. And what questions should I ask these people? How do I know if their reliability is any good or not? Which was a breakthrough, I thought. That was a wonderful thing.
Yeah, to get it talked about.
Yeah, but it's one of those things that it took, and there was plenty of stories in all kinds of industries where like a we had a electrolytic capacitor, and at HP that went in pretty much every single product, right? Anything with a power supply had an electrolytic capacitor, multiple of them in it. And somebody hired a senior engineer out of one of the top tier producers out of Japan, and he went off and helped them formulate a new capacitor that was a little bit less expensive. So the procurement organization loved it. And this was, you know, a semi-reputable company and all this good stuff. And they go, oh, we can save, you know, billions of dollars. They always overestimate. And they you know, we got all these capacitors and they started being built into it. Unfortunately, that the designer forgot to put in this little component that avoids the capacitor from blowing up after 3 months. You know, and they used the venting as a euphemism for when it would basically burst open and spread electrolytic fluid all over everything and cause just all kinds of damage. Not a good thing to be around. And it was in hundreds of thousands of products at that point. And so it was one of those classic cases of, you know, we did the failure analysis and did all the other good stuff. But the failure analysis included, why did we pick these things? Where was that mistake made? And what was the driving force? And it ended up changing the bonus structure for the procurement organization away from cost. It factored in the quality and reliability so that if you bought a product and it caused a recall, essentially, you were going to be no bonus for you, man. No soup for you.
Fantastic. Fantastic. You know, my mind is racing here, trying to envision. I'm thinking about, wouldn't it be nice to have a forum, maybe a panel somewhere where we could discuss what works and what doesn't work in terms of supplier reliability? Because there's so much raw material for this discussion.
Oh, yeah.
You know, different things that we've tried. I'll share one with that has worked really, really well. And I'd just love to hear, you know, your stories and other people's stories on this. Back in the late 1990s and early 2000s, we were just getting started on reinitiating an Impala program at GM. Of course, Impala is a brand that has a rich history. And so we had a brand new Impala program coming up. And we wanted to do this one better than ever. And we, at the same time, we're also coming up with a new CTS for Cadillac, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to introduce these programs better than ever, come in at world class. And so on selected programs like the Impala and CTS Cadillac, we said, let's start. Amongst other things, this is only one thing, but amongst many things, we said, let's start with our critical parts. So rather than, you know, the 10,000 parts that are involved in an automobile, let's, for this particular program, let's select the 30, 40, or 50 most critical parts, and let's make sure we get those right. Along with everything else we do, let's nail those most critical parts. And mm-hmm. so we identified those based on a combination of warranty reviews, new technology, based on, you know, a set of criteria, and we sifted through and said, here's the most critical parts. And for those critical parts, we did two things in addition to all the other due care. Number one, let's make sure the supplier FMEA for those parts is done very well. So my reliability group would review and approve their FMEA. Number two, and here's where I was going, is the reliability testing for those critical parts. The test plan need to be approved by my group ahead of time, and the reliability results need to be approved. And so we set up some mechanisms, and we actually got to purchasing, and we got it into the contracts that they would submit their FMEA, submit their reliability testing to our group before they shipped the parts, and they had to have our approval. And we got that into the purchasing contract, and it was just an amazing lever. And I don't know if that's still in place, but I just wanted to share that experience that it really helped those programs come in at a higher level of reliability.
Well, it changed the conversation with the supplier, just slightly. Is mm-hmm. you know, and I one of my first supplier visits, my boss said, well, let me start this off. And we met, you know, three folks from the supplier's company, and we said hi and welcome and, you know, come this way. And before we even got to the first conference room, he was already talking about how are you guys going to reduce cost? And I'm like, we're the design for manufacturing engineering team, right? We're the design for reliability team. And your first question is, how are you reducing cost? Where are you going with this? And then he asked about cost reductions and the path for cost reductions and how you're going to achieve the cost reductions about 50 times in the first hour.
I think kind of get the message after a while.
Yeah. And I'm, at the break is like, what are you doing? We're here to make sure that they produce a quality and reliable product. And he says, but it doesn't make any difference unless they can reduce the cost. And I'm like, really?
Oh,
this is kind of short-sighted. I mean, he didn't last in that role very long. And but it's by adding it to the contract. And I know other companies have done this, and to the point where if a product has a failure, a massive failure or warranty cost that's caused by, say, your component or your subsystem, a supplier subsystem, you pay for the entire structure, the entire system, not just the replacement of your power supply. You pay for the entire server. HP didn't do that. But it was considered in a number of parts of the organization, and some companies did. And it dramatically changes the attention the supplier pays to what's important to you as you're requesting their parts. Now, big companies have different leverage than small companies, so your mileage may differ. But if the only thing you ask for is cost, then they're going to pay attention to that. If you ask about cost and delivery time, well, they'll pay attention to both those things. But if you add quality or reliability and sometimes very fundamental basic questions, they go, oh, these guys are paying attention to this. We need to meet that criteria because they actually care about it. We used to call it trust and verify. Right. We trust you're going to do a good job. Right. We're going to trust you're going to do a good job. You want to do business with us and you want your products to continue to be supported in our product designs. But we're going to verify what you say.
Yeah, very good. I wonder how many people could if a reliability engineer. If you're listening to this podcast, just take a note of this and check it out. If for some of your critical parts, go and look at the reliability specifications for those parts. In other words, look at the product specifications and see how the reliability requirements look.
Oh, it's almost always MTBF, unfortunately.
Yeah. And so if you can get those in the documents that have reliability specified properly.
Yeah.
Based on, you know, the four key elements of a reliability requirement. And if you can get those specified properly, and then if you can even go further than that and get a seat at the table when you're selecting suppliers to have a voice, so it's not just cost and timing and that type of thing, but it's reliability capability as part of that decision process. If you could do those two things, get a place at the table. So reliability is considered as part of purchasing contract, and also make sure that reliability is properly specified in the most critical parts. That would go a long ways.
You know, one of the allies I got for helping get more influence in the supply chain and the procurement organizations was the designers and the operations folks, the guys manufacturing the products, because you've heard me say this before, Carl, and I'm sure our listeners have heard me say it, is that as the manufacturing team, it's the poor quality or poor reliability is always the designer's fault, right? Manufacturing can only make it worse. We can't make it better than the design.
Right. But
when you break that down and look at it closely, though, the design is just assembling these 10,000 components that somebody else made. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We're just arranging them. Right. If that metal is bad, or if this capacitor has the wrong electrolytic solution in it, or if this, you know, whatever, from a supplier or from a supplier, the vast majority of major problems in the field, we blame manufacturing first because they made it. And then we blame or accuse or look at the design real carefully. But we, and then sometimes it gets narrowed down to a component, and then we say it's their fault. Well, it's a mixture. It always is.
It is a mixture.
Right. And if we don't include the suppliers early on, we may be walking into a trap inadvertently that we design in a product that shouldn't be there. But if we had talked about it, here's how we're going to use it, the full reliability definition, they would say, no, you don't want that because that won't work there.
Yeah, so such a great conversation, Fred. I remember years ago seeing lists of problems. You'd have like a fracas list mm-hmm. of problems, and then there were three columns next to that list. It's a design problem, it's a supplier problem, it's a manufacturing problem, and you're supposed to check which one it is.
Right.
And I hated those lists
right.
because there's no such thing. It's more complex than that.
Yeah.
As I teach, and I've never been to a company that doesn't have more than 50% of their problems at the interfaces or integration. And in other words, it's the interface of your system with the supplier part in some way.
Yep.
There's an integration or interface problem. And that's where a lot of the problems occur, is at that interface. And if you don't have a good communication with the supplier early on, so you can have them participating in that design, the system design in a relevant way, you're going to have problems.
You know, and I'm keeping up my theme of being a fly in the ointment kind of thing is mm-hmm. early on in my career as working in a polymer plant, we were making cables. We were having a problem from batch to batch of this material, not having some specific properties, but it was very expensive for us to figure out if it was okay or not. We'd put lots and lots of construction and go through a bunch of processes before we could measure it to say, yep, this is good or not good. And it would go through all these steps and we'd have to scrap this 10,000 pound batch of polymer, but only after a lot of work to figure it out. So we got a hold of, it was DuPont that we talked to, and they invited us out to see their process. And we sat down with their scientists and we were trying to figure out what was it about their product, what aspect or characteristic of it had the variability that tracked with or physically caused the change in performance of our product. And we were, and likewise, they came to us and we went through our process and they were watching how we manipulated and handled and treated their product. And they were looking for, well, that would cause, you know, this chain of events to occur and you would get these results. But it was very much a cooperative, they sent two engineers, we had two engineers, and we worked together on an improvement project so that we were both successful. Now, one of the things that was refreshing about it early on is it wasn't us saying, hey, your product's too variable, it doesn't work for us. Because we realized we didn't really know if we were doing it ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. Our process could have been the one out of whack. We didn't think so, right? They had a pretty stable process, but we were using their product on the edge of where it's typically used. So they looked at it as an opportunity to learn how to make their processes improve and get our insights and vice versa. So it was a very much a joint project and very open and very refreshing. Compare that to my old boss that walks in the door, cost reduce, cost reduce, cost reduce, cost reduce. It's all I care about.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Very adversarial kind of thing.
And you know what comes to mind in this discussion is roles and responsibilities. I've been to many design teams in my consulting practice, and I go, well, what about this supplier part? And they go, well, that's not our responsibility.
Yeah.
We're responsible for...
We pick the part out of the catalog, or we yeah. give them a design and they got to go build it. You know, and, yep. yeah.
Ugh. So then the question becomes, who's got the responsibility for supplier, yeah. for the reliability? I can answer the question, who's got the responsibility for supplier quality? Incoming parts, does it meet performance? Is it dimensionally correct? Does mm-hmm. it have the right materials? That I can answer. The company can answer. But who has responsibility? Let's say the widget has a one, this is a thought experiment. The widget has a 1% problem that'll occur at midlife.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, so you're not going to find that on incoming parts. You can measure all the dimensions you want. You won't necessarily get that in the plant. in your system testing, you probably don't have enough samples to discover a 1% problem on a supplier component at midlife. So where is that problem going to be discovered? That could be a very serious problem. That could be a lot of money to the company. A lot of people are upset about it if you have a high volume. And so this question, without in our podcast, without giving necessarily the answer, I think the first step is to realize that there's a question. And for reliability engineers to think about it and to work with your management to surface what is the path to discover those kind of problems, and so that they don't happen too late.
I can see that we're going to have to come back to this topic because I'm just biting at the bit because there's there. I mean, I've had some success stories with this, with just priming the folks that are going to go visit suppliers or working on those contracts. You had success by getting it built into the contract language for critical parts and so on. I know there's other ways that it can be successful, but it's one of those when you realize that a good proportion of your product comes from third parties and is assembled and put out into the market. And it's, as you said, Carl, it's that interface piece, but it's somewhere in there in many organizations, in our experience anyway, that gets dropped. And I think it can be solved with just getting the part of the discussion to include, how's this thing going to work over time? How do we know it's going to work over time and so on? And yeah, there's many more horror stories. We'll have to save an episode for around the Halloween timeframe. There's some disaster stories in there.
Indeed. Well, that's great. But I would love to hear from listeners as to what your experience has been. Is supplier reliability on the radar at all? And if so, how do you address it? And what are some of the things that have worked? And if you have any questions about it.
Yeah. And, you know, Carl, we're going to have to come back and try to nail down how do you get it started at an organization if it's not there? But I think getting the feedback from our audience is what are the barriers that they're seeing or what are their successes? That would help us really make a really powerful and useful episode.
Good. Yeah, it would.
Definitely. Right? Yeah. So head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. There's a contact form there for us, and you can provide as much or little detail as you'd like. And feedback's always appreciated. You can find us on email, on our about pages. We have contact forms there also. And also on LinkedIn, you can certainly find us there. And we certainly appreciate the stories, the feedback, the inspiration. And I've even heard, Carl, last week I heard from somebody saying, I had my boss listen to these two, you know, X, Y, these two episodes you did, and what I've been lobbying for months became easy. They got it.
That's a good story.
And I'm like, oh, cool. And, and so tell me more, which episodes were they? But it helps. So we, every now and then we hear success stories where these discussions are actually making a difference. So we certainly hope they do. That's a big part of why we're sharing this information, is to help you in make reliability happen for your customers, those kinds of things. So anyway, Carl, thanks a whole lot. And I think this episode's coming out right at the end of December, early January. So it's going to be a happy new year and a good time to set your reliability goals if you don't like doing, what do they call it? New Year's resolutions.
Right.
Set reliability goals. Much
reliability
more practical.
Resolutions.
That's right. It's much more practical.
All right. Well, thanks, Fred.
All right. Talk to you later, Carl.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.